You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of March, 2024, on Monocle Radio. It is 1730 in New Delhi, 1400 in Jerusalem, midday here in London, and 8 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program.
The majority of Israelis support our governments. If Senator Schumer opposes these policies, he's not opposing me. He's opposing the people of Israel.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu lashes out at Western criticism during a visit by Germany's Olaf Scholz. We'll look at the two leaders meeting this weekend. After that, we'll head to India, which is about to embark on the world's biggest democratic experiment. We'll talk about a responsible AI summit in Cambridge, and then...
This is a modern and ambitious agreement, and our membership of this exciting, growing and forward-looking bloc is proof that the UK's doors are open for business.
The UK's Trade Commissioner for the Asia-Pacific region tells us why the UK deserves to be the first European country to join a trade deal with Asian and Pacific nations. And finally, we'll hear from Melanie Leach of the British Property Foundation. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. Over the weekend, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz made his second trip to the Middle East since the October 7th attacks. And the atmosphere this time around was a very different one. Scholz reportedly found more in common with Jordan's King Abdullah, who he visited on Saturday, than he did with Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, who he met with on Sunday. Netanyahu has increasingly chafed at Western criticism and doubled down on his plans to finish the war against Hamas by invading Rafah in Gaza's south. Well, joining me now from Berlin is Stephen Erlanger, chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe for the New York Times. And I'm also joined by Yossi Meckelberg, an associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House and a lecturer in international relations at the University of Roehampton. Stephen, let me start with you. This was a tricky visit for Olaf Scholz, as it frankly always is for German chancellors. What did you make of his line, his balance?
I think he did it pretty well. I mean, the Germans have been very upset for months now at the rising toll of civilians in Gaza. I mean, Germany feels a special relationship for all the reasons we understand with Israel. The survival of Israel is a reason of state of Germany. It has laws against using Nazi phrases. It cracks down on all forms of anti-Semitism. But it is also very unhappy with the way Israel is conducting the war, which is true of Joe Biden. Increasingly, it is one thing, as Scholz said, to defend oneself. Israel has certainly the right to do it. But as he said, no matter how important the goal, can it justify such terribly high costs? Are there other ways to reach your goal? Part of the problem everybody has with Bibi Netanyahu right now is we're not sure what his goals really are. I mean, he says there are two things: to destroy or dismantle Hamas in Gaza and to free the hostages. Some people think those are contradictory and may not be possible. So this leaves Scholz in a conundrum. I think he balanced it pretty well. He was more open than usual in his criticism, but it was mixed as ever with support for the right of Israel to both exist and to defend itself against terrorism.
Yossi, let me bring you in on that. Germany has been, as Stephen was outlining there, kind of one of Israel's strongest allies throughout this, but not without criticism. How is Olaf Scholz seen in Israel? What kind of influence do we imagine him to have with Netanyahu?
Hello. I think, you know, from all the reasons that were mentioned, the history between Germany and Israel, Germany is many times few steps behind in criticize Israel at times, that there is a good reasons to criticize Israel behavior or certain governments' behavior, but it got to this point, and I think most of the international community has right now very strained relations with Benjamin Netanyahu. and with the policy towards Gaza. The question is not whether the West, the international community, the United States, the EU, support Israel. This is the case. The criticism is the way it conducts the war in Gaza, the way that more than 31,000 people are killed there. Joseph Borrell actually said just today, the foreign minister of the EU, that there is a deliberate policy of starving the population in Gaza. You know, whether it's correct or not, this is the view right now in Europe, that this is part of the war. This is one of the methods, and this is unacceptable, and rightly so, for the international community. So it's Germany, it's the European Union and such, and we hear, of course, the criticism coming from the United States. Now, 5 months, nearly 6 months after the 7th of October, why the world was behind Israel in responding to Hamas and with retaliating to what Hamas did and ensuring it doesn't happen again, it loses patience with the way Israel actually conducts the war.
And Steve, I wonder how much, if you could talk a bit about how this is being played out in Germany itself at the moment. Yossi mentioned there that Germany is sort of a few steps behind. That's not necessarily the case when it comes to the German public, is it? I mean, how has Scholz tried to balance this line with his domestic audience?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's partly generational. It's true in America, too. But I mean, there is a younger generation who was certainly born after the Oslo Accords and after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who has known nothing in the Israeli-Palestinian story other than tension, aggression, warfare. And Israel is seen increasingly as a colonial power and an oppressive power, and being the victimizer rather than the victim. So this is strong, and Germany also is dealing with, it is worth saying, an influx of young people from the Middle East who were refugees who came in the big waves of a few years ago, many of them single, many of them from Syria, many of them from Afghanistan, who are slowly integrating into German society, but painfully, but who have lots of reasons in their past and in what they've been told by their community to be very angry with Israel and very, very obviously worried about Palestinian lives. And so, Germany has this new community that it must cope with, while at the same time it bans pro-Palestinian demonstrations that veer into what Germany considers anti-Semitic demonstrations. Like the phrase "from the river to the sea" is really not part of discourse here, because the Germans regard that as calling for the end of Israel. So it's very difficult. And also, he comes from the Social Democratic Party, which has always been, you know, more to the left. And he's trying to manage that and support for Ukraine at the same time. And it is a complicated balance.
Yossi, Netanyahu has bristled at the criticism from the West and kind of stood fast in his line, whether that's criticism from Germany or from the United States. He's also rejected this idea, of course, of another election that came from Chuck Schumer, as we heard at the top. I just wonder from you to end, is there any country or leader at this point that kind of has his ear and might shift any kind of policy that he is considering?
Well, at this point, I think Netanyahu is detached from reality. Just what, you know, the clip you play said that when Schumer criticized Israel and said that's what the people say, and says, no, the people support the government, he should read every public opinion polls and his survey and say that actually the vast majority of Israelis would like to see fresh election, and they don't support Netanyahu. And you know, their priorities, the release of the hostages, and moving on from there, which doesn't seem to be his priority. I think at this point, yes, he doesn't listen to him because he had set a priority. It's always as Israel is working on a parallel, completely universe than the rest of the world sees the war in Gaza. At the same time, even if he doesn't listen to him, there are enough levels of power. There is enough enough pressure that the United States, if it wants, and Europe as well, at least to change the course of the war. No one actually suggests to Israel not to fight against Hamas, but at the same time would like to see a deal of a ceasefire, would like to see humanitarian aid enters into the right quantities inside Gaza. So at the same time, it's not whether he listens, but whether they make him listen to them.
Stephen Erlanger and Yossi Meckelberg, thank you very much for joining us here on The Briefing. Now here's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Russian exit polls handed Vladimir Putin a predictable victory in sham presidential elections. Mr. Putin claimed 87% of the vote in the rigged election on Sunday, cementing his rule for another 6 years. Iceland has declared a state of emergency after a volcano erupted for the fourth time since December in the Reykjanes Peninsula. Residents were evacuated over the weekend as lava erupted from a nearly 3-kilometre-long fissure. North Korea fired ballistic missiles in a display of defiance coinciding with US Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to Seoul for a summit for democracy. The summit, which runs until Wednesday, is Mr. Blinken's first stop on his brief Asia tour, which will also include a visit to the Philippines. And the Michelin Guide will unveil its yearly selection of top French restaurants today. A total of 62 restaurants will be awarded stars, with the majority receiving the honour for the first time. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Sophie. Now, this is the year of elections around the world, and that includes in the world's largest democracy, India. Over the weekend, a date of April 19th was set for India's next elections, or at least the start of those elections, as they'll be carried out over 44 days and in 7 phases. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is widely expected to win a third term, despite some concerns over a crackdown on India's democratic institutions. Well, the journalist Maya Sharma joins us now from Bengaluru. Maya, this is such a massive undertaking. Let's start with that. Tell us about the process and how it might differ from past elections.
Well, this election is quite simply the largest in the world, beating the record of the 2019 elections held in India also. We're looking at over 960 million people who are registered to vote, who are eligible to vote, out of India's massive 1.4 billion population. And even, of course, if not all of them roll up to the polling booth on their particular day of voting, you're still looking at hundreds of millions of people in over 1 million polling stations. The logistics are just overwhelming. And it is also very, very long. It's a very long election going on from, as you said, the 19th of April to the 1st of June, with counting only on June the 4th. And this is, in fact, the second longest election in Indian history, the longest being the very first election held back in 1951 to 52. So it's a really, really long election to try and cope with the logistical challenges, security challenges in certain states, and it goes on for a very, very long time. And it's going to be full of the usual heat and noise and dust and excitement and madness of the Indian elections, and it's going to be something to watch.
So heat and madness, as you describe it, although at the same time, Narendra Modi's party, at least, is presenting this election as something of a bore, a foregone conclusion. I mean, is that the case? Do you feel they are right on that? Is victory as certain as they say?
Well, the BJP and its whole alliance, the National Democratic Alliance, the NDA, they are certainly trying to present this as a done deal, that they have won it already. They're talking about focusing on the next election in 2029. And in fact, in a recent interview, Prime Minister Modi actually went so far as to say, why 2029? We're thinking of 2047, which is, of course, 100 years since India's independence. So they're trying to present this as a done deal. It certainly would look as if they are hugely dominant, especially in the northern states of India, where the large population base is, and as a consequence, more parliamentary seats are. They do seem to have that dominance in the northern part of the country, which would give them the numbers. But of course, it's also something they would want to present, so that even people who perhaps wanted a change of government would think, what's the point? What's the point of my going out to vote when anyway the BJP is going to come back? So it's interesting. And the BJP certainly are masters of presentation and spin. So they are definitely presenting this as a done deal. Is it? Well, of course, India has been known to spring surprises in the past. Over the years, of course. But certainly it does look as if the BJP does have the upper end at this moment. It does have the upper hand right now. And it is looking for a third term for Prime Minister Modi.
And is there anyone in the opposition that, aside from just challenging Narendra Modi, is there any talk of sort of some of the reasons for Modi's not only popularity, but perhaps the fact that he is to some degree undermining some institutions in India? Is that a topic of this election? Is that something he is being challenged on directly?
Very many challenges on this issue, in fact. The alliance which is trying to take him down, the India alliance, the Congress along with other parties have got together to try and present some sort of opposition. They are attacking him basically on these issues. The fact that there is certainly an exception of reducing of civil liberties, of journalists being under threat, of minorities not feeling as confident as they were in earlier years. We've had recent actions taken which do seem to be also putting a bit of pressure on the minorities as well, more than a bit, in fact. We've had the celebration of the Ayodhya temple, the temple at what's supposed to be the birthplace of the Lord Rama, temple being built there, which is seen as a kind of success for the Hindutva push of the BJP. We've also had the Citizenship Amendment Act brought in, which gives minorities, non-Muslim minorities from neighboring countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Bangladesh, access to Indian citizenship, but leaves out Muslims. And we've also had the abolition of Article 370 in Kashmir since the last election, which is also a tricky thing in many ways. So there are many ways in which the BJP is being attacked on these things. We've had several journalists put into jail for being critical of the establishment, for asking questions. And there is definitely a challenge to Prime Minister Modi and his BJP government, the NDA government, on the issue of civil liberties. But how successful that will be, because the numbers do certainly seem to be with them. We're looking at a little over 37% of the popular vote in the last election, because this is a first-past-the-post system over here. So 37% is not like a huge majority or anything like that in terms of votes, but they've got the numbers when it comes to the seats. And they will be hoping that it is the minority of voters who will be against the policies that they have been introducing over the last 10 years.
Maya, thanks very much. That was the journalist Maya Sharma speaking to us from Bengaluru. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio, and I'm Chris Chermak. Later this week, Cambridge here in the UK is hosting a Leaders in Responsible AI Summit. It's the second iteration of the summit, which brings together government, civil, defence officials and academics for a series of role-playing exercises around artificial intelligence. Here to tell us more is Ramsay Brown, the CEO of Mission Control. It's a software company focused on AI safety, sponsors the summit, and Ramsay is also a senior research associate at the Intellectual Forum at Jesus College, Cambridge. He joins me now in studio. That is a mouthful. Good morning, Ramsay.
Good morning to you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the summit itself, just from the title of it. I mean, everyone, frankly, these days, it feels like, promises that AI will be responsible. What makes this summit different?
We sought out to create the summit that we thought was missing in our field. And summits tend to be, you show up, there's a few keynotes, you sit through a panel of predominantly interchangeable, predominantly white, predominantly dudes. You go to a lunch session, fall asleep halfway after, and continue and rinse and repeat for a few days, only to get a handful of business cards in your pocket and not much else. And we sought to create something radically different in this space. So this is an exceptionally hands-on practical exercise for about 70 to 100 people who we've gathered from around the world, senior leaders from various industries, nations, and roles around artificial intelligence, who are going to try to tackle two of the largest outstanding questions in our field, for which they will work as small cross-disciplinary teams with one another, unsealing envelopes of prompts they've never seen before around our space, and they have 90 minutes to come up with practical, tangible, and useful proposals at the technical level, policy level, cultural level of how we're going to address these problems in 2024. And this year, our two topics are focusing on the 2024 election cycle and artificial intelligence – and what our field can learn from the success of the cybersecurity field about helping organizations wrap their head around large change paradigms. And these two subjects are at the tip of everyone's tongue in our space. And we saw this as an opportunity to get the world's brightest people in this space into one room to work and hash out and break down some of the barriers that usually stand between us and get to really good practical answers.
It's interesting that you picked those two topics, and we'll get to those. But I wanted to ask, first of all, this is the second iteration of the summit, and I'm just curious what has changed in your mind in a year. Last year, it feels like the technology of AI was kind of sprung upon us with all of these companies suddenly producing ChatGPT and all of these things. But it still felt like it was in its infancy, at least for the public, maybe not for you. But how did that affect the summit at the time compared to now?
So we started planning the summit far before that. And we started planning the summit before the first iteration of ChatGPT came out. We started working with Cambridge saying, "This, we're going to do this in March. This is what we're going to do. We propose this." And it sounded like a slightly more fringe or academic exercise then. And then ChatGPT hit for the first time in November 2023, abouts. And suddenly this became very practical. I was in Midori House right before, like the day or two before our previous summit, and GPT-4 had come out like the day prior and had pushed the state of the art substantially in terms of model capabilities. And what we've seen between now and then has been a practical reminder that when people say the phrase accelerating change, we all have this collective notion of what that must mean. And I think most of us think like something, something VR goggles, something, something gadgets, something, something iPhones, where it's like about the physical stuff, as opposed to practically speaking, accelerating change means that every single day we'll see compoundingly more innovation and change and progress in this technology than all human history days prior. And a very visceral reminder of that is how substantially now things have changed between when we had the summit this year and had the summit last year in terms of model capabilities and then cultural awareness. We have seen that the adoption of these technologies and the integration into daily lives, business processes has, in a jagged edge kind of way, advanced substantially for some fields, lagging behind in others. But now everyone's aware that there is this thing going on, that we are at the precipice of the industrial scale of synthetic intelligence, and that this has real tangible implications for how they live their lives and how their communities and jobs and families actually operate. Everyone's aware that now this is something that is no longer a interesting theoretical laboratory conversation. This does apply to them, even if their job is not in the field per se.
There is definitely that cultural awareness. There's also a government awareness now. We did last week kind of have coming through the European Parliament the first legislation trying to tackle that. I'm wondering how that feeds into your summit as well. What governments are doing, what the EU is doing, is that something in itself that is feeding into what other countries are looking at, a kind of model for some sort of global treaty or something to really tackle what it means to have responsible AI?
It's one of the biggest open questions in our field, because every major jurisdiction now has some form of either on the books or in process regulation around AI. The big open question is how many jurisdictions are going to follow the EU's model and how many are going to follow the United States' model. The United States' model is largely focused so far around creating standards for technology and devolving the regulation of specific applications down to states. What this means is that at a federal level, there is not strong regulation about what you can and can't do with AI, and that makes it extremely attractive for businesses and innovators who understand in a very practical sense how badly we would like to say, oh, innovation and regulation don't need to be at odds, but practically they are in this space.
And you go to the state with the least regulations, frankly.
Because you're going to have the easiest time to try new things to see what the market needs there. The EU has taken the stance that, and they will admit we're good at regulating, we're bad at innovating, and they've taken the stance that we're going to have a larger, more heavy touch regime around how to use AI. And in practice, a lot of folks in the space are looking at that and saying, I don't know how I'm supposed to operate within this. And it's our prediction that there's actually going to be an exodus of companies and capital from the EU as a consequence of this. And everyone's very confused about why this went forward in the way it did. And I think it's going to be one of the open questions over this year, especially as France, which is rapidly becoming a contender in the AI space, is going to exert some pressure back against this act and say, well, I know we really set it to be this stringent. Is there a way we can actually get it to be a little less enforced because we have domestic industry now that's one of the front runners and I don't want them to be kneecapped by this? So I think we're going to see both how it gets played out this year and how then industry in Europe does push back against the act itself.
Well, this kind of brings us back, though, to your summit as well, because the question then is, if you're saying that what the EU is doing is too heavy-handed and sort of not helping innovation, that leaves it up to the industry to be responsible and have summits like yours. But to what extent can you, frankly, assure even listeners that the industry will have an approach that is responsible, that you are able to game out all of the risks that are involved in AI, the misuse of AI? You mentioned elections, for example, as well, a huge topic, of course, this year with so many elections around the world.
And it's why we convene the summit and why we do the work we do and work with the organizations that we work with multilaterally to better push forward what actually can happen within the realm of like the art of the possible and within the art of the purchasable from the enterprise and the state's perspective. The last thing we want to do is propose solutions that are going to be dismissed as that's wishful thinking or that's magical thinking, or yeah, there's no way that my CTO or CISO is actually going to sign off on that, so we're not doing it. It's our responsibility to be able to convene these organizations and groups that can push those answers forward well. So I'll point to the two topics of the day that I think would be illustrative. The first around the 2024 election cycle and AI. We've got more than 60 major contests this year in Democratic elections and the backdrop of an increasingly multipolar world. And we're already seeing in the United States and other countries the use of generative AI, especially in creating deepfakes by Joe Biden, especially not by Biden's team, but like of Joe Biden by adversaries to dissuade Democratic voters from participating. This is the tip of the iceberg, we believe, around this. And this is the kind of thing that I think we're actually going to need some legitimate form of really light federal level regulation. And to be fair, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has actually stepped in and banned domestic sourced deepfake political phone calls. Of course, what's then not being played into that regulation is that doesn't stop someone running a server farm in an apartment building in Minsk using a masking for a phone number in Alabama to then dial out to some pensioner in the States and convince them that Joe Biden or Donald Trump are really on the phone. Whole separate problem entirely. In terms of like, what can the industry do around responsible use of AI, we're working with our colleagues and our co-sponsors at Booz Allen Hamilton and our colleagues over at the Responsible AI Institute for this summit this year to introduce something that we're calling the Top 20 Controls for Responsible AI. And we drew our inspiration from the cybersecurity world and the work by an organization called CIS that maintains the top 20 cybersecurity controls that are functionally what every large organization uses as the how do I get started and how do I keep going with cybersecurity to keep my organization safe. Something like that is missing in responsible AI. We have virtues and ethics and risk management frameworks and model registries. We have all of these tools, but we don't have that thing that tells someone, here's how you go from 0 to 1 or 1 to 2 for your organization. And they're incentivized to do this now because it's starting to get the attention of the C-suite, of boards of directors, of investors and analysts and the market who understand this not as a do the right thing kind of maneuver, but as a this is the basics around contemporary business practice in the digital world in a way where we started looking at that for cybersecurity 10, 15 years ago. That is now happening. So what we need to develop is what's that toolkit to help people go from 0 to 1 or 1 to 2 through this journey. That's part of what we're going to be working on at the summit, and it's part of how industry, academia, and not-for-profits can collaborate here with the state to provide alternative pathways alongside regulation to make this profitable and safe for everybody.
Ramsey Brown, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Ever since Brexit, the UK has been busy expanding its trade ties with countries and regions outside of the European Union. And this year, it hopes to become the first European nation to join the Asia-Pacific Trade Agreement known as CPTPP. Two countries have now ratified the UK's participation out of 11 members after a deal was reached in principle last year. Well, earlier I spoke with Martin Kent. He's the UK's trade commissioner to the region. I began by asking about the process of getting parliaments to approve.
You're right, we're making really good progress with what's called the entry into force of the CPTPP. Japan and now Singapore have already ratified the UK's accession to CPTPP, and there are other countries to follow, and it will be the back end of this year when UK businesses for the first time will be able to use those rates and tariffs as part of the CPTPP agreement. We're very excited about that as a country. It will be 12 countries with a combined GDP of 12 trillion. And also home to about half of the world's growing middle class, which is particularly important as the UK looks to grow our economic interests across the Indo-Pacific region.
How have you been making the argument to local parliaments over there in the Asia-Pacific that Europe, for that matter, this will be the first European country joining the UK, that it deserves a space in this Asia-Pacific partnership? And how might you exact sort of your own influence once you're in there?
But the UK has really strong diplomatic and political relationships across the region. You know, as the fifth largest economy on earth, whether it's Japan down to New Zealand, there's deep historic links that have united the UK with countries across the region for some time. The UK recently has had a real emphasis on refreshing and renewing our relationships across the Indo-Pacific, and that's manifested in both diplomatic, political, and also economic terms. Last year was really a bumper year of inward investment into the UK from the Indo-Pacific region. We signed the Hiroshima Accord between the Prime Ministers of Japan and the UK. Alongside that came a commitment of over £17 billion worth of inward investment into the UK. We also last year, with the Korean state visit, Koreans signed about £21.5 billion worth of investment into the UK last year. And that comes on top of a rich tapestry of trading relationships that we've set up. There are free trade agreements in Japan, in South Korea. There's an economic partnership agreement in Taiwan. There's free trade agreements in Australia and New Zealand and Vietnam. We have a digital economy agreement with Singapore. So we have a rich tapestry of relationships across the region that we're reinforcing by this process of entering into force of CPTPP.
So the fact that you have all of these individual trade agreements that you're describing, arguably that's part of the reason that, as I understand, economically joining the CPTPP is not that hugely significant in terms of the bump for the UK economy. It's also more symbolic, isn't it? And in that sense, what is this about for you? Is it in part about, frankly, countering China particularly, which would like to become a member itself and something that you could have influence over if you were a member?
So the CPTPP will give us new trading relationships, free trade agreements with Malaysia and Brunei. And never before have we had a trading relationship, a free trade agreement with Malaysia or Brunei. So it's expanding the range of countries in the region where we have a free trade agreement. The amounts itself, we estimate it will add over $6 billion to our trading relationships in the short term. And that's set to grow. The CPTPP, as you say, is a dynamic agreement. It is a trading agreement that's designed to expand. That's how the UK was able to join the CPTPP.
Well, and as you said, though, to follow up on that, it is dynamic, and that means that's how the UK was able to join. What is your perspective on other countries joining, a country like China or others in the region? Is that something you would like to see?
So individual members of CPTPP never state their own personal opinions on which countries can or should join. But what the group has made clear is that the CPTPP membership is open for expansion. And they've laid out the Auckland Principles, which are three criteria that must be met for a new member to join the CPTPP. First and foremost, they have to demonstrate that they have a high standard of international trade. You know, the CPTPP is a high standards trading agreement. Secondly, they have to show a commitment to the international rules-based system. And thirdly, they have to achieve a consensus of all members of CPTPP. It is a consensus-based partnership, and therefore any new member would have to achieve consensus. So the CPTPP have laid out those very clear guidelines in terms of the expansion, but it absolutely is a trading relationship and a trading group that is open to expansion.
And what about the trade rules and regulations specifically, how that will evolve as well? I mean, one aspect of this that's interesting for the UK is there's some risk perhaps of divergence with the European Union, which is sort of still your closest trading partner despite Brexit and how that relationship has evolved. Is the European Union involved in this at all? Are you having consultations with them as you go about joining an Asia-Pacific partnership to ensure that the rules and regulations of both are not that different?
We have an extremely strong trading relationship with the European Union that continues and will continue well into the future. And that will sit alongside the growth in our relationships across the Indo-Pacific region. We are committed to really high standards of trade to serve our consumers and businesses well. And we're also committed to making sure that trade deals are fit for the future. And that's a global effort. We're not going to solve issues like sustainability and net zero by not working collectively as an international community.
That was Martin Kent, the UK's Trade Commissioner to the Asia Pacific. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally on today's show, we are off to Cannes, which last week played host to MIPIM. It's the world's leading property fair. Among those in attendance was Melanie Leach, the chief executive of the British Property Federation, the voice of the real estate industry in the UK. And with the UK also in an election year, Monocle's Andrew Tuck spoke with Melanie about how the housing crisis is impacting voters and government. He began by asking what Melanie believes needs to change in the world of British property.
So the heart of the manifesto is that message around partnership. It's around trying to reset the partnership between the industry and national government so that we can really unlock investment and unlock delivery. And we've grouped it around four main themes. And the first one is around unlocking growth. I mean, we can't unlock growth, we can't drive productivity in the UK unless we've got the right built environment to do that. So whether it's lab space, whether it's offices, whether it's retail and leisure, or whether it's the homes that workers need close to their jobs, we can't unlock that productivity, that growth, without the built environment. The second theme is around housing. We know we've got an acute housing crisis in the UK, so we really have to do better at unlocking the delivery of homes. The third one's around town centres. We know that a lot of our town centres really need reinventing for the 21st century with the sort of shrinkage of the retail footprint, some of the other changes that are now happening in the office market. We know we're going to have to reinvent a lot of those buildings in town centres and bring footfall back to thriving town centres. And then the last one's around decarbonisation, because the built environment, it's a big part of the carbon challenge, around about 25% of emissions. So we have to be a big part of the solution. But beyond that, you know, not only decarbonising the built environment, but also we think we've got a fantastic opportunity to deliver clean energy back to the grid. Because if you think about warehouses being the obvious example, we've got masses of roof space, you know, that's good for solar or other forms. We've got masses of ground space to think about alternative clean forms of energy. So we think we've got a big part to play in decarbonisation and driving the clean energy as well.
Well, let's look at some of the challenges. So I guess the first thing is the capital to do all those things. We have a government that's still trying to cope with the fact that there's not enough capital in the system to fund the things that it wants to do. I know one part of your solution is you thinking going outside the UK to look for people who want to fund these projects. But how do you even begin to fund all this work? Because as you say, some of these problems are endemic and have not been able to be chipped away at all by some of the governments we've had.
So I think the issue is not the availability of capital. We know there are billions of pounds available within the UK and across the globe wanting to invest for the long term in projects like infrastructure, in homes, in regeneration, in decarbonisation. So I think the challenge is about finding the right environment and the right levers to unlock that investment and to make it possible for investors to come in. And that's why I think the partnership is so critical between government and the public sector and the private sector. So that's everything from trying to create the right vehicles for all of the money that's locked up in pension funds and insurance funds to come in and invest, through to de-risking projects to make them viable. I mean, viability is the key challenge for a lot of what we're talking about, particularly outside London and the South East. So how do we create viability? How do we de-risk so that capital can come in and invest with confidence for the long term? Because, say, it's not the availability of capital that's the problem, it's actually finding the right framework, the right environment that allows that capital to come in and invest.
When we look at affordable housing, a thorny issue for everybody, but again, what are the challenges there? Because I know that on some sides, actually, some investors are cautious of affordable housing because of the returns they need to make for their shareholders. In many communities, affordable housing is desired, but then people don't want it built next to their houses. They don't want densification of urban cores because they want to protect their nice suburban housing. Why does it just not happen, the scale of development we need around affordable housing, do you think?
So there are lots of really interesting models emerging for private capital coming into the affordable and social housing space, whether that's setting up for-profit registered providers or whether that's partnerships with housing associations, so that things like sale and lease back, so the private capital takes the assets but then leases them back to the housing associations to run. There are all sorts of different models emerging, but not at the scale that we need. So in our manifesto, we call for the continued need for subsidy. There will always need to be subsidy for social housing, but we reckon that if government committed to somewhere between £9 and £14 billion, you know, that broadly unlocks the same amount of investment from the private sector. So that delivers around about 145,000 homes a year. So there's a huge opportunity, again, with the right structures in place, to unlock private capital to come in alongside subsidy to really drive the delivery of affordable housing.
Do you think both parties have a plan about what the future of property could look like in the UK? Because it's contentious on both sides. You know, for the left, the need for social housing is a little bit stronger. On the right, the feeling that sometimes if you left the market to its own devices, it would resolve many of these issues. But in between, do you think there is some consensus about what could be done to make the landscape look a bit better?
I think there's a couple of things to say there. I mean, firstly, I think there's an understanding that you don't deliver the kind of either the economic benefits through improved productivity and growth, or the social benefits in terms of decent homes, thriving communities, lower energy bills, decarbonisation, without the investment that comes from our sector, from property. And I suppose there was a light bulb moment at the party conferences last year when both the leader of the opposition and the shadow chancellor both majored on talking about building and planning in their speeches, which is, you know, kind of unprecedented. And I think that's because not only were they hearing from the property sector, which you might say, well, we would say it, wouldn't we, you know, that planning was a barrier to getting stuff done, but they were hearing it from all of our customers. They were hearing it from manufacturers, they were hearing it from retailers, they were hearing it from the life sciences sector. So all of the sectors that they think are fundamental to the economy were all telling them planning is a blocker, we can't build, we can't get the factory space, we can't get the logistics space, you know, that we need. So I think the planning system, you know, is under scrutiny and recognised as an inhibitor that could be a really powerful driver for growth and driver for better social outcomes than it ever has been.
That was Melanie Leach of the British Property Federation speaking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck at MIPIM. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio managers were Mariella Bevan and Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time, but before that, listen out for a special bonus episode of The Briefing, publishing later today. Our first program recorded live at the recent Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City, Dubai, will be appearing at 1600 London time. You can find it at monocle.com, in the show pages, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your audio. That's all for now. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.